Beijing is angry, but just how angry? Today, Tuesday, May 20th, this is The World. I'm Marco Werman. No big surprise, but China is not happy that the U.S. has charged five of its military officers with cyber espionage. So what's the next move for the People's Liberation Army?
Maybe they'll do absolutely nothing and then 6 months from now launch a massive cyber attack. It's very hard to say.
Real comforting. Also, the White House says the CIA can't use polio vaccination campaigns as cover anymore. But will that make a difference in Pakistan?
The average individual says, I live under the control of the Taliban, so I dare not vaccinate my children.
And later, a big fine for a Swiss bank that helped Americans avoid taxes, and a new gig for Bolivia's president, Evo Morales. Hint, he'll be wearing a number 10 jersey. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. China is not happy, and it clearly wants Washington to know it. Beijing says the U.S. charges against five Chinese military officers for cyber crimes are groundless, and that the charges are badly damaging U.S.-China relations. Today, China's foreign ministry summoned the new American ambassador, Max Baucus, for a talking to. Isaac Stonefish is Asia editor at Foreign Policy magazine. He says it was surprising how fast the Chinese government reacted, especially its defense ministry.
As soon as the indictment came out, they had a very strong statement that they posted on their website, really laying into the United States for trying to indict at what they called members of the Chinese military on so-called commercial cyber theft. So this does make me think that the Chinese knew about this, that the Obama administration gave them the courtesy of letting them know pretty far in advance, and they were ready with a statement when the indictment came out.
And Ambassador Max Baucus, so what kind of tough talk do you reckon he got a dose of?
I think they gave him an assistant foreign minister. So I think it shows that they were displeased with him by calling him in so early and that they, at the moment, may not think too highly of him or the charges by having him be dressed down by someone so low on the totem pole.
Interesting. So are we about to see retaliation from China for these charges? And what form do you think retaliation might take?
I mean, we're dealing here with one of the most opaque branches of the Chinese ruling party, the Chinese government, the PLA. And I think we are going to see some sort of—
That would be the People's Liberation Army.
People's Liberation Army, right, which is the military of the Communist Party as opposed to the government. And they are, yes, probably the most difficult to understand part of the Chinese state. And I think they're going to retaliate, but exactly how and exactly when is almost impossible to say. Maybe the Pentagon will see an increase in retaliation cyber attacks. Maybe it'll be more difficult for U.S. military officers to get visas to China. Maybe they'll do absolutely nothing and then 6 months from now launch a massive cyber attack. It's very hard to say.
What about the argument in China that the NSA in the U.S. does this? So why shouldn't any other country, that there's a double standard with U.S. justice blaming China for hacking?
The DOJ really tried to make a distinction between economic and corporate espionage, which is what these five soldiers are accused of, and regular espionage, which from WikiLeaks and from Snowden, it's pretty clear that the U.S. does as well. I think this distinction was lost on most Chinese, in part because it's a pretty nuanced distinction, in part because Chinese media coverage of this did not make a fine point of that distinction. And I think a lot of the reactions we've been seeing on Sina Weibo, which is a major Chinese social network, is this kind of spying happens everywhere in the world. The U.S. very clearly does it. Why is the U.S. calling out China for doing what they do as well?
Yeah, and the U.S. counterargument is that these are Chinese military hacking into U.S. companies, private companies, turning secrets over to Chinese companies to help them, to assist them, and that the U.S. does not do that. True or false?
That's what they're trying to say. And I think, you know, we know that the U.S. government did hack into Huawei, a major Chinese telecom company, but we don't know how or exactly if the U.S. government shared secrets that they learned from Huawei with U.S. companies in order to give these companies a competitive advantage. And that's pretty clearly what Beijing does.
On another front, Isaac, China's hosting Vladimir Putin this week, and that's got to be in some ways more eyebrow-raising for the U.S. than hacking right now anyway. Are we seeing an anti-U.S. alliance from two BRIC countries right now?
It is, but I don't think we have to worry about an anti-U.S. alliance. I think China and Russia's interests are very different, and I think the U.S. should take comfort in the fact that this trip is mainly a business one. If Putin's lucky, he'll be able to sign this massive gas deal with China, which will start pumping over the next couple of decades. We'll pump $400 billion of gas into China from Russia, and this is a really nice lifeline for Russia's struggling economy if Russia can get the deal together. But I think China really wants to communicate to the United States that its rise is going to be peaceful. Putin does not want to do that. And I think China knows that the closer it gets with Russia, the more difficult it is to maintain a really good relationship with the United States, which is one of China's paramount, if not paramount, foreign policy goals.
Isaac Stonefish, Asia editor at Foreign Policy Magazine, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
A few years ago in 2011, it was American spying in the spotlight after U.S. forces found and killed Osama bin Laden in Pakistan. Later, it emerged that during the hunt for bin Laden, U.S. intelligence agents used a phony vaccination campaign as cover. The CIA worked with a Pakistani doctor who knocked on the door of the bin Laden compound, pretending to want to vaccinate the children there, but in reality trying to obtain a DNA sample. The trick failed when the doctor was turned away at the door. Now the White House says the CIA won't be using that tactic anymore. The White House has even written a letter pledging that. Lori Garrett welcomes that pledge. She's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and she says the CIA's fake vaccination campaign in Pakistan did a lot of damage.
There already was a tremendous disinformation campaign going on in the Islamist world, especially in northern Nigeria, claiming that vaccine campaigns were all part of some Judeo-Christian / CIA conspiracy to either sterilize the children of the Islamic world or give them HIV infection. So using a fake vaccine campaign threatened not only the lives of vaccinators who would be accused of being involved as co-conspirators, but it also threatened to build on an already pre-existing campaign specifically against polio vaccination.
Okay, so now it feels like the narrative is kind of out of the White House's control, and yet this pledge comes from the White House that the U.S. won't use vaccination campaigns as a cover for spying ops. What do you make of that pledge?
Well, it's long overdue. I'm very happy that the National Security Council and the Department of Homeland Security have reached the conclusion that this was a nasty thing to do, but more importantly, that they've allowed it to be leaked out, if you will, by sending it to the deans of several schools of public health and a large number of government officials. But we've heard things like this before.
When groups like the Taliban or Boko Haram portray a vaccination drive as a Western plot to sterilize Muslim kids or any kind of Western plot, is there evidence that local residents actually accept that narrative?
What most interviews show is that people say, the average individual says, it's not a question of whether I believe it's true or not. I live under the control of the Taliban, so I dare not vaccinate my children. In other words, fear dominates the narrative.
We've seen polio increase in several countries around the world in the last couple of years. How much of this increase can you blame on this use of vaccination campaigns to gather intelligence?
I think it's irrefutable that the failure to adequately vaccinate the population of northern Pakistan is key to why we have now a reversal of fortunes in the war on polio. The genetic matches of the polio strains that showed up in the sewers of Israel, showed up in the refugee camps surrounding Syria, showed up among children in Syria, showed up in a case in Baghdad. All of this traces back to the northern Waziristan Fatah region of Pakistan. And this is the region most heavily controlled by the Taliban, where numerous Taliban leaders and imams have declared fatwas against polio vaccinators. The whole war on polio, going from only three countries in the world having active polio in circulation, the whole world being on the verge of eradicating the disease, and now 10 countries have polio. The World Health Organization last week declared a global state of health emergency, and we're losing the war, all I say, because of a combination of the Taliban and Boko Haram extremist views on vaccination administration and the CIA inadvertently directly feeding their paranoia and providing them with the evidence that they needed.
Laura Garrett, the author of The Coming Plague and Betrayal of Trust, thank you.
Thank you.
It's been a busy week for the U.S. Justice Department, not just bringing charges against those Chinese military hackers, but also settling a criminal case against Swiss bank Credit Suisse. The bank pleaded guilty to charges of conspiring to aid tax evasion. And as a result, Justice slapped Credit Suisse with a $2.6 billion fine. That's billion with a B, you heard me right. But don't worry, the bank's shares closed up today in Europe. Mark Blythe is a professor of political economy at Brown University and joins us now from London. We've seen banks do bad things and then they get fined. This seems to follow the same narrative. But what is the surprising part of this Credit Suisse story for you, Mark?
Well, the surprise is that there's a criminal indictment, but then you have Eric Holder, the Attorney General, saying in the back of the criminal indictment, yes, it's great. It's the first time that a bank's gone down for a decade. No more settling for civil penalties or admissions of wrongdoing and then a big fine and all this sort of stuff. It's a criminal indictment. Then you ask the question, right, then who's going to jail? And the answer is no one, because hundreds of people were involved and you can't possibly jail the whole bank.
So what I read in shorthand is that basically Credit Suisse helped Americans evade taxes. Is that right?
Yeah, that's it in a nutshell. But you have to think about this in a broader perspective. When you're doing this, what you're actually doing is international money laundering. Because although you're avoiding taxes, and people try to avoid or evade taxes all the time, in order to do this, you have to bust through several anti-money laundering and anti-terrorist conventions. And that's where the criminal liability comes in. It's not just morally dubious or bad business practice. It's actually criminal.
What kind of pain will $2.5 billion actually inflict on Credit Suisse?
Well, the fact that the senior management haven't resigned in the wake of this and that they say they're committed to the bank tells you that probably not a great deal. I mean, so far, I believe that the total figure for fines arriving for the financial crisis is, I think, $100 billion. Now, that sounds like an enormous amount of money until you consider that the total size of the European banking system, for example, is around $45 trillion in terms of its asset footprint. So it sounds like a lot of money to a normal person, but to a hugely levered financial institution, it's really not that much.
Do banks just look at the system worldwide and say, we can do pretty much whatever we want because the fines are not that bad?
To a certain extent, I think that's sadly true. One of the large missed opportunities after the crisis was to say, okay, maybe it was the case that these guys were too big to fail. Maybe the issue of systemic risk and contagion would have led to generalized bank runs and we would have blown up the whole system. But now we've bailed it out, let's make it smaller. Let's make it safer so that we can actually allow these guys to fail. And it would also mean that they're also big enough to jail, because along with too big to fail goes too big to jail. And when you don't fix the too big to fail problem, you don't fix the too big to jail problem. So those two things go together. And unfortunately, the reforms so far right across the world have really failed to tackle with this issue.
So they've done the crime and they've paid the fine. I mean, we still need banks, right?
Well, that's kind of an open question, actually. I mean, the funny thing about these very big banks, you know, so Credit Suisse is one of them. You could look at JP Morgan and others. They make 70% of their profits through trading, basically swapping bits of paper with each other for arbitrage gains, none of which arguably adds to anything except global liquidity and doesn't really do much for real investment. So if you factor out the vast majority of what they do, the question is, do you really need them? Well, you need bits of them, but it's not clear you need those bits. And those bits are the bits that tend to get into trouble.
Are you really arguing that we could do away with banks in the modern age?
I'm arguing that what we could do away with is a lot of the leverage games that banks do that lead them to be billions of dollars in terms of their asset footprints and systemic risks to the taxpayer.
Mark Blythe, professor of political economy at Brown University, speaking with us from London. Thank you.
Thank you.
Blythe's view is only one side of the story. In Switzerland, breaking bank secrecy laws can mean fines and up to 3 years in jail. The Swiss authorities have responded to U.S. complaints by defending their nation's laws, which have maintained bank secrecy for hundreds of years. That's left Credit Suisse and other banks stuck between two conflicting legal codes.
The World is brought to you by PRI and supported by Medtronic, helping build more resilient communities by supporting the American Red Cross so it can be ready to provide assistance whenever and wherever disasters occur. Learn how you can make a difference at AmericanRedCross.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. So what is going on in Libya? Fighting in the streets this week, some of the worst violence in Tripoli since the revolution that ousted Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. And just a few days ago, gunmen stormed into parliament, forcing the government to suspend its work. It just seems like the place is about to blow up. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki says the Obama administration is asking everyone in Libya to keep calm.
We are continuing to call on all parties to refrain from violence and to seek resolution through peaceful means. There are a range of mechanisms to do that through the international community, and we're focused on helping to resolve the differences.
But many Libyans don't see an end to the violence, and they fled to neighboring Tunisia. Officials there say up to 500,000 Libyans live in Tunisia now, and many feel trapped. Marine Olivezi has our story.
Abu Ahmed and his 8 children moved to Hammamet 2 summers ago. The seaside town is known among Libyans for its sandy beaches, luxury hotels, and wild nightclubs. But Abu Ahmed says he just came here for his family to be safe. Abu Ahmed was a butcher in Zliten, a small town in western Libya. He says in August 2012, an Islamist militia took advantage of Libya's instability and overran the town. He shows me a video from that night. Abu Ahmed and his family fled to Tunisia right after the attack. He says what's especially frustrating is that just a month earlier, he'd voted in Libya's first free elections. Abu Ahmed and a Libyan friend break into a nervous laugh. I cast my ballot, Abu Ahmed says, and then it's like they took my voice away and forced me out of Libya. Tunisia hosted tens of thousands of war refugees during the uprising. They were generally in favor of the revolution, and after Gaddafi was killed, they went back. But then another wave of Libyan exiles arrived, those fleeing the chaos, like Abu Ahmed, and the pro-Gaddafi Libyans, who were terrified about their fate in the new Libya.
It doesn't matter if they like Gaddafi or not. It doesn't matter for me. All of them Libyan. All of them Libyan. All of them my family.
Fouad Tegbali runs a charity foundation for Libyans in Tunisia. He says he's helping all the Libyans in need, and so should Libya's new authorities. Instead, they're ruling the country with the same old with us or against us mentality as before.
In the time with Gaddafi, we cannot say Gaddafi is wrong. And now you make the same mistake. If you someone he like Gaddafi, has to say. Why not? You like Gaddafi? It's okay. Make political group without guns, without hate, without nothing. You like Gaddafi? Welcome. It's your land. Free speech. This is the democracy. That's why we make revolution.
In Libya's new penal code, any criticism of the revolution or insult to the Libyan state or flag can put you in jail. But with militias ruling the streets, it sometimes takes even less than that to get in trouble. Another man, Ahmed, says he was accused of being pro-Gaddafi just because his grocery store was in the wrong spot. And so he fled, too.
I was just a civilian, but my shop was right next to a military base. Once rebels reached Tripoli, they stormed the base, came to my store, and accused me of selling food to the army. It was a grocery store. Of course I sold food to them. I sold food to everybody. But in their eyes, I had aided and abetted the enemy. They burnt down my shop, then my house. I had to leave and took my family here.
Ahmed has no job in Tunisia and little savings left after nearly 3 years in exile. Last month, a group of Libyan officials came to Tunis and promised refugees like him they'd be safe if they were to move back. Ahmed says the officials can't even protect themselves, so what could they possibly do for him?
Libya, up until this moment, it's not a state. It's a state in name only, run by militias. If you're going back, you're going back to death. Every day in Libya, there's more killings, more kidnappings. How can they tell us to come back and promise to protect us? Militias have managed to kidnap the Jordanian ambassador, even the prime minister. So how couldn't they kidnap and hurt regular citizens like us?
Ahmed says he's lost hope he'll ever be able to go back. And he actually can't go anywhere else. A few months ago, his passport expired. Libyans in Tunisia have to travel to Tripoli to get it renewed. Stateless, Ahmed says. That's what we've become. For The World, I'm Marine Olivezi in Hammamet, Tunisia.
What if President Obama joined the Washington Wizards and played in the NBA? At 52, the president's in pretty good shape, and he plays hoops in his spare time, so why not? Obama might want to give that some thought after he hears what Bolivian President Evo Morales is up to. The World's William Troop has his scoop.
Evo Morales, ladies and gentlemen, has just been offered a contract to play professional soccer in Bolivia's First Division Championship. He's 54, so a little old for a pro. And it's not every day that a president, no matter what age, plays pro in any sport. But this isn't totally out of the blue for President Morales.
Evo Morales is known as an absolute football fanatic. He's also known to play a little bit. And he played a very high-profile game a few years ago, right up the top of a mountain to prove that football can be played at altitude.
That's reporter Tim Vickery, who covers South American soccer, or football as they call it over at the BBC. Vickery thinks this is probably no more than a publicity stunt for the team that Morales will be playing for. That team is called Sport Boys Warnes. Its president, Mario Kronenbold, spoke to the BBC's NewsHour, and he was asked point blank if this is in fact a PR gimmick.
On the one hand, yes, for our club it is. On the other hand, we're fulfilling a dream of our president, who loves football and who has never stopped playing. And he's playing well. He plays good passes, has great control of the ball, and a strong shot with his right foot.
Just imagine the possibilities. Our friends at BBC Mundo did. Okay, let's not get carried away. Kronenbold says he's not expecting Morales to win his team the national title. He also points out that Morales is signing a contract with Sport Boys only because he has to comply with the rules of employment for anyone playing for a professional soccer team in Bolivia. But he's only going to be making minimum wage, which in Bolivia is the equivalent of about $215 a month. As we heard earlier, Evo Morales has played high-profile games before, usually friendly games, but some have gotten ugly, including one where police reportedly tried to arrest an opposing team player after he committed a particularly bad foul against the president. Kronenbold says when Morales plays for his team, things will be different.
Well, the president won't enter the pitch with his presidential sash. He will enter as a regular player. He will have to be marked, and if he gets fouled, he will have to recover. We don't want the presidential title to have any influence on the pitch.
Good luck with that. Sport Boys Warnes is not one of Bolivia's top soccer teams. It's just 9th out of 12 this season. And no one is expecting Morales to line up for every game. Kronenbold says he'll play just a handful of matches whenever his busy schedule allows. And each time, he'll play only 15 or 20 minutes, which does make you wonder, what's the point? Publicity for the team, yes, but what's in it for Morales? Did I mention he's up for re-election later this year? Tim Vickery points out that Sport Boys is based in Bolivia's lowlands region, where Morales could use a popularity boost.
His stronghold is much more the highland areas of Bolivia, so currying a little bit of favor in the lowland areas might do him some good electoral success.
President Evo Morales has a few more months to get in shape for his new gig, or gigs. The next soccer season in Bolivia starts in August, and the presidential election is scheduled for October. For The World, this is William Troop.
And you are listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. You know those guys in balaclavas in eastern Ukraine? Only their eyes are showing. So how do they eat? Well, one of our BBC colleagues recently had tea and cakes with them.
They would be pulling up their balaclavas to eat the cake under their masks. It was just so surreal, people having to lift up their masks to eat.
That's just ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service in London, PRI, and WGBH Boston. It was our London office at the BBC that tipped us off to this next story. Check out the headline, Behind the Balaclavas Embedded with a Ukrainian Separatist Militia. If you've seen the pictures from eastern Ukraine, there are a lot of armed men, and they are all men, with scary balaclava face masks, you know, just the eyes showing. Figuring out who they are is very difficult. If you ask them, they don't answer. In fact, they often just don't talk to reporters. But somehow, our colleague at the BBC, Paul Kenyon, managed to get the commander of a pro-Russia brigade to let him spend time with his unit.
When we first met this guy, Alexei, he was a building contractor. He was a man who had risen up through a building company, run it himself, and then had some political views which he used to take on the streets. He would stand on a soapbox, if you like, and get very small audiences, mainly of elderly women. And that gradually changed. And so the next time we saw him, he'd got a lot more angry about things. And this, interestingly, was to do with the West, America and Europe, supporting what he would call the illegal government in Kiev. He then had meetings in Moscow. He came back, he had uniforms with him, he acquired a following of 100, 150 men. They were all in uniforms as well. At that point, they didn't have guns, but we met up with him again about 5 days ago. They all had guns. They are on a secret camp very close to the Russian border, and they live there and they train together. We said, where did you get these weapons from? You've been backwards and forwards to Moscow. Where did you acquire them? And this is what he said.
Barack Obama.
Barack Obama. Barack Obama gave us weapons through his politics. If he stayed at home and ran his own country and not poked his nose into others, there wouldn't have been any weapons, not in Syria, not in Libya, and not here.
So that's one commander, Alexei. What about the protesters in eastern Ukraine? What kind of people are they? Are they as determined and organized as Alexei?
They are, and we were in a position where we went to see some pro-Ukrainian troops, and these were a militia, a private militia, so they're supporting the Ukrainian government and they're supporting the West, America and Europe. And when we got there, they'd been surrounded by a group of pro-Russians who were all screaming, they've kidnapped some of our young men. This escalated and escalated and ended up with all the pro-Russians getting into cars, setting off into the local town and taking over the police station in a matter of about 10 minutes. And this is what happened.
They're going in through every window of this police station now. And men are just running in there with balaclavas and baseball bats.
Yeah, that is a pretty dramatic scene. I mean, you also got access, Paul, to some of the town halls that have been taken over by separatists. Once you get behind the scenes in those town halls, what is the mood?
It's surreal. It's surreal because in one of the key town halls that was taken over in the city of Donetsk, you basically have 10 floors of people wearing balaclavas, skeleton masks. All of them have got baseball bats or chair legs, so they've all got weapons.
And the skeleton masks, those are balaclavas with kind of the pictures of skulls on them, so it's pretty scary stuff.
It is pretty scary. You do wonder why they go for a skeleton mask because, they're only in the building and they're talking to mostly their friends and quite often their family members as well, who've all occupied these buildings together. I've actually got to tell you, when you get into these buildings, and I would look at them all and I'd think, you all look extremely threatening. Mm. So you walk through these buildings, and my attitude was that if I go over and try and shake their hands, some of these people have got to be reasonable. And actually they were. They'd shake your hands and they'd say, we're making Molotov cocktails over here, or, you can come over here and see we've got little old women making us tea in a corner here. There'd be little old women making tea for them and cakes. They would be pulling up their balaclavas to eat the cake under their masks. So this would be going on for sort of, you have to climb through 11 floors of this, and then on the top floor, above all the madness, there's a council meeting, and these people don't have masks. They're sitting there having a pretty surreal debate about the future of their region. But these are sort of local politicians, local teachers, local businessmen. And if you didn't know better, if you were just sort of zapped there from outer space and landed in this room, you'd think it was in a local town hall anywhere in America or Europe. It looks perfectly normal. It's only when you open the door and you see men with machine guns and Molotov cocktails and skeleton masks that you realise it's something different.
Yeah. Meantime, downstairs, it's tea cakes or Molotov cocktails. What's your pleasure?
It is. I've got to tell you, it's Easter when we were in one of these buildings and they were cutting up an Easter cake and we were filming them and watching them. And I was thinking, there's going to come a point where they're going to have to eat this. And all these guys have only got holes for their eyes, not for their mouths. So it turned into a sort of surreal comedy moment, which we decided not to put in our film, actually, because it was just so surreal. People having to lift up their masks to eat.
So now we're hearing Russia is withdrawing some of its troops from the border, and there's been this call for protests against its troops from Ukraine's richest man, as we alluded to. Is the tide turning against men like Alexei and the pro-Russians?
I think that's how America and Europe would like to see it, to, if you like, comfort ourselves, perhaps. But
you don't see it that way.
I don't see it that way, not on the ground at all. these people have gone so far that there is absolutely no turning back. When you get a man who used to run a building company, who's now got his own private army of about 100 to 150 trained militia with AK-47s and machine guns, this is a man who's not for turning back. And this is happening repeatedly through that area. So even if the Russians continue to back off, the word on the ground is these men will not give up until they're absorbed into the Russian Federation. So it becomes a fairly intractable situation.
That was the BBC's Paul Kenyon telling us about his time with separatist militia members in eastern Ukraine. They might not be making big headlines at the moment, but the talks with Iran over its nuclear program are far from over. The latest round wrapped up last week in Vienna. Iran and the six world powers at the table, including the U.S., have until the end of July to come up with a final agreement. And if there is a deal, it would be one of the biggest diplomatic achievements in U.S.-Iranian history. So where exactly do the talks stand at this point? We asked Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, for an update.
I think there was a little bit of unease on the part of the five permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany that the Iranians came in with some very tough demands. The Iranians are still talking about retaining thousands of centrifuges, increasing the number of centrifuges that they have so that at some point they would be able to produce fuel for nuclear power plants. Now, this is not entirely unexpected. This has been the line the Iranians have been taking. But time is short if everyone wants to meet a deadline of July 20th to finish negotiating a long-term nuclear agreement. And the Americans, the French, the British, and others have made it pretty clear that they will not accept a large number of centrifuges remaining in Iran's hands, at least in the initial stages of this agreement, because the whole purpose of it from the Western point of view is to prevent Iran from getting close to making nuclear weapons. And that means putting limits on the number of machines that they have that can enrich uranium potentially to weapons grade.
Right. So zoom out, if you would, and give us the macro shot of these talks. I mean, I've followed the progress, but also a few steps backward, and yet the talks remain alive. Where exactly are we?
I think this was to be expected in a way. The Iranians are excellent negotiators. They came in with their maximalist demands for this agreement, knowing full well that they're not going to get that. But they wanted to put that on the table. On the other side, they want sanctions relief, and they want it pretty quickly. So we're seeing, you know, the beginnings of this kabuki dance to get toward the agreement. I think the next session, which is scheduled in mid-June, will be much more serious, and they actually will begin to start drafting this long-term agreement. In between, remember, there are contacts going on. It's not like they meet once a month. You know, they don't get there and then they leave in a huff and wait for another month. This is a completely different process from the one that we saw under President Ahmadinejad. Now you have daily contact between technical teams on both sides, sometimes between our Secretary of State and the Iranian foreign minister, between Wendy Sherman, our chief negotiator, and the Iranians. So this is a process, and we have to look at it as a process with occasional sort of more public moments like these meetings in Vienna. I remain relatively optimistic that they will get an agreement because I think it's profoundly in the interest of both sides. The Iranians need sanctions relief. They need some positive momentum to get that society out of the funk that it's in, to move the economy, to convince people that President Rouhani is the real deal, that he actually can achieve something. And on Obama's side, on the Western side, I think there's a desperate need for a real diplomatic achievement in the Middle East with everything else going sour. Syria, the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, Egypt, you name it. Iran is the one place where there might be a significant diplomatic achievement.
I mean, yeah, just getting to sit in the same room had been a challenge, and now they have been. So having followed these nuclear talks for years, what is different this time around?
What's different is the direct contact that they're talking on the phone, sending emails on a daily basis, that the negotiators refer to each other by their first names, that they know something about each other's families. You never had this degree of intimacy between the United States and Iran in a negotiating forum, not one that was publicly known about anyway, not for a very, very long time, and really not ever at this high level since the 1979 revolution. It's quite extraordinary. you know, I was at an event, an off-record event with an Iranian negotiator recently, and the language this negotiator used was very similar to that used by our negotiators. They're absolutely speaking the same language. They negotiate in English. There's no need for translation the way there used to be with Saeed Jalili, who was the head negotiator under Ahmadinejad. The people in the room are Western educated, and they have a very good understanding, I think, of American domestic politics, probably better than we do of their domestic politics. So all of this does give me hope that they can finally reach an agreement. I'm not saying this is guaranteed. I'm not saying it's inevitable, but there are profoundly good reasons why the two sides should reach an agreement.
Barbara Slavin with the Atlantic Council in Washington and the author of Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies. Always good to speak with you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
In Egypt, a presidential election at the end of this month. Not a lot of news coverage about that, maybe because most people consider the result a foregone conclusion. General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi is expected to win, hands down. He's the former defense minister who ousted Egypt's Islamist president, Mohamed Morsi, last summer. But there is another candidate on the ballot. Ursula Lindsay reports from the campaign trail in Egypt's Delta.
It's a weekday afternoon, and Hamdine Sabahi, the other candidate for Egypt's presidency, has just arrived. He's speaking to a room of about 1,000 supporters in the northern town of Zegazig. 2 points in Sabahi's speech get the biggest applause. One is when he says, "The day is coming when all those imprisoned for peacefully expressing their opinion will be free." And he names several local young men who are in prison. Sabahi has promised to amend a law that restricts the right to protest and that has sent thousands to jail. Sabahi, a leftist, was a critic of the Mubarak regime and was himself arrested many times. The other time the crowd roars is when he declares, "The Egyptian army is not above us, above the people. The army protects and serves the people. It doesn't rule." Sabahi supported the uprising against Mubarak in 2011, and then the revolt against the next president, the Islamist Mohamed Morsi. Sabahi also backed the army's intervention to remove Morsi in the summer of 2013, and he backed the crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood that followed. Mohamed Heba is with the Sabahi campaign. He says Sabahi and his supporters respect the army, but the way Sisi has taken personal credit for saving Egypt from the Muslim Brotherhood, and the way he stayed on as defense minister when he was planning to run for president, was wrong and unfair.
Abdel Fattah el-Sisi played a role in bringing down the Brotherhood, but we reject the fact that he was in power during the transition. And then, when it suited him, he took off his uniform and put on a suit and said, "I'm a civilian and I'm running for president."
This isn't the first time Sabahi has run for president. He came in third during the 2012 elections. But this time around, his campaign had trouble gathering the required 20,000 citizen signatures. Mohamed Heba says people were scared to put their names down.
One of the problems we faced is that people would say, "I'll vote for Hamdine Sabahi, but I don't want my name registered." It's fear. The gains we made in the revolution, we've lost them now.
Other candidates from the last election have declined to run this time around. They say their presence would only legitimize an unfair election. So that just leaves Sabahi, running against a candidate who in many ways acts like he's already president-elect. Sisi won't take part in a debate, he doesn't give live interviews, and his public appearances are tightly stage-managed. Yet despite the sense of inevitability, Sabahi's supporters insist that their man has a real chance. "It's not settled," says campaign volunteer Radwa Eldarandari. "Every day, things are turned upside down." For The World, I'm Ursula Lindsay, Zegazig, Egypt.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. The torrential rains may have stopped in the Balkans, but the floodwaters have yet to recede. One of the hardest-hit areas is Obrenovac, just outside the Serbian capital, Belgrade. There, the waters rose so fast that many residents didn't even have time to grab any belongings. Thousands were evacuated to makeshift shelters in Belgrade. Freelance journalist Mitra Nazar has spent the past few days visiting those shelters and what's left of the city of Obrenovac.
And when I arrived, the city was totally flooded. People were standing on the roofs to wait for the rescue teams to arrive. It all happened within 15 minutes. The water rose till like the first story of many houses.
This is more than just small villages and towns. I mean, this is a city of 30,000 people. Where have these people gone and when can they go back to their homes? Do they know what their current status of their homes is?
Many people have no idea what their house looks like at this point. Thousands have been evacuated, most of them in Serbia to Belgrade. Hotels, every possible place opened their doors for these people. So they're staying now in the capital on improvised beds.
Were you able to speak with any of those people who fled and came to Belgrade? And what have they told you?
Yeah, I spoke to many people. They told me the story. I mean, they woke up and they saw the water coming. And you cannot imagine, people told me that they had never thought of how strong water can be. A woman told me that she saw the water coming and she got into her car. The car was still on dry land. The moment she got into the car, the water already arrived to the car, so she couldn't drive. She couldn't leave. So she ran back into the building to the top floor and waited and saw the water rise. And so it's very hard to imagine what that looks like.
I mean, just facing a rush of water through your living room has got to be a seriously scary sensation. The rains, I gather, have stopped, but the Sava River and the Danube remain very swollen. And there's big concern that this could impact this power plant, the Nikola Tesla power plant just outside Belgrade, which provides half of the nation's electricity. Will that plant survive?
The authorities keep giving mixed information. One day they say the plant is safe. The next moment they say it's at risk. If you look at air pictures from the plant, you see that it's totally soaked. There's water all around it. You cannot imagine that the plant is still functioning, but it is. They're mobilizing volunteers from everywhere to go there to build sandbagged walls around the plant. That's one of the biggest concerns at this point.
Freelance journalist Mitra Nazar speaking with us from Belgrade in Serbia. Mitra, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, things could get weird with this next story. Luckily, we've got a weekly spot for just that sort of thing. We call it our sideways glance. It's a place we carve out for our quirkier stories. This one's about a K-pop band called Crayon Pop, a girl group from South Korea. They've got a devoted fan base, and that fan base includes a passionate group of middle-aged men. Jason Strother, who is not middle-aged, has a story.
Jung Jung-hoon seems pretty excited when he shows me this video on his smartphone. It's of him and other guys in their late 30s and 40s singing and dancing at a concert by their favorite girl group, Crayon Pop. Not only do they know all the lyrics and choreography, they're also dressed up like the five 20-something singers too. Jung describes his concert getup: sneakers, a red tracksuit embroidered with his nickname, and a white construction helmet with a strip of red electrical tape on it. He says it's no different than going to a baseball game and wearing your team's uniform. Jung says he's not embarrassed by his fondness for K-pop girl groups, and there's a whole online community of men who feel the same way. Newsflash: older men are attracted to younger women. Okay, that's a no-brainer, but Mark Russell, author of the new book, K-Pop Now, says there are other reasons why middle-aged Korean men and women like these songs. It's in part due to the economics of the music industry here.
Korea doesn't have a very diverse music market at the mainstream level. Most of the money is in today's music. That's where the record companies put their energy. It's more out there. It's what you're going to encounter. Overwhelmingly, it's the music of now that's in the public consciousness.
But this borderline obsession that some older Korean men have with Crayon Pop goes deeper than that. This video shows about 50 middle-aged men chanting the names of the singers in the group. They're all wearing the signature workout clothes. It's part of a media art exhibition on these men who've supported the band since they started out as street performers.
One guy told me that he always keeps his trainers and helmets in his car trunk because he doesn't want his wife to know about it.
Jung Yeon-do created this exhibit. He says Crown Pop aren't the prettiest or most talented K-pop performers out there, but they give off the impression that they've worked really hard to achieve success. And that strikes a chord with these older Korean men.
They got the feeling of healing from supporting these girl groups. To be successful is hard. You know, when you graduate school, you have dreams to be something. But, you know, when you're getting older, and not many people actually achieve what they want to be. So if you see someone has a strong desire of trying to be successful and show the passions, and that moves people.
Crown Pop fan Jung Jong-hoon says that's what got him hooked. I think these singers in Crown Pop are working really hard, maybe harder than other groups, he says. I know how that felt when I was in my 20s. And that hard work seems to be paying off. Crown Pop will open for Lady Gaga on her North American tour this summer. Though Jung says he's not so sure American men will feel the same way about the girls as he does. For The World, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul. Get set, ready,
go. That's our program today. You can get the latest from us on Twitter when we're not on the radio. We're at PRI The World from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. Thank you for being with us.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund. Donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. By the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, ritaallen.org. By the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. And by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and strengthening international peace and security at carnegie.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.